in terms of snakes, insects, diseases, weather, and the difficulty of travel. Only two people on the expedition had actually seen the Valley of T1 up close, Juan Carlos and myself. Tom Weinberg did a brief flyover of T1 in 1998 on a mercy mission with the U.S. military on their way to deliver supplies to stranded villagers after Hurricane Mitch. Although the storm had derailed their plans, Steve hoped Tom might spot something in the mysterious valley he was convinced held a lost city. So, Tom persuaded the pilot to alter his flight plan to get a quick look-see en route, but there was nothing but dense tree cover. No one had been in there on the ground in perhaps hundreds of years. There was nobody to ask, no guidebooks to consult, no maps beyond the LIDAR images, and no way of visualizing what we would find in the ruined city. It was both unnerving and exciting to know we would be the first. Elkins and Benenson had hired three British ex-Special Air Services officers to handle the logistics of making camp and navigating through the jungle. Their leader was Andrew Wood, who suggested people call him Woody. Woody had served in many roles in the SAS, including senior instructor in jungle warfare, explosives and demolition expert, and advanced trauma combat medic. He spoke Arabic, Serbo-Croat, and German. He was a skilled tracker, sniper, and free-fall parachutist. After leaving the military, Woody had founded a company called TAFS, Television and Film Facilitation Services. The company specialized in bringing film and television crews into the world's most dangerous environments, keeping them alive so they could shoot their projects, and then getting them out safely. TAFS handled the logistics for the extreme survival shows of Bear Grylls, and the company's numerous television credits include Escape from Hell, Man vs. Wild, Extreme Worlds, and Naked and Marooned. Woody, himself a trained survivalist of the highest rank, had been asked many times to star in his own show, but he had always refused. Woody brought along two partners from TAFS, Ian McDonald Matheson, Spud, and Stephen James Sullivan, Sully. Despite their self-deprecating British manner, both were also ex-SAS and tough as nails. The three had very different personalities, and each played a role. Woody the manager, Spud the friendly and laid-back doer, Sully the drill sergeant, whose role was to intimidate, dragoon, and scare the shit out of everyone. As we gathered for that first briefing, we had a chance to look around the room and meet our fellow expeditioners for the first time all in one place. A few of us had been involved in the original LIDAR aerial survey. Tom Weinberg, Steve Elkins, Juan Carlos, and Mark Adams, the crew's sound mixer. Most were new. They included Anna Cohen and Oscar Neil Cruz, archaeologists. Alicia Gonzalez, anthropologist. Dave Yoder, Julie Trampush, production manager. Maritza Carbajal, local fixer. Sparky Green, producer. Lucian Reed, director of photography. And Josh Fieser, camera operator. Bill Benenson and several other members would arrive later, once camp was established. Woody proceeded to give us the deadpan, hair-curling lecture about snakes and disease that opened this book. Then it was Sully's turn to speak. Sully, who had spent 33 years in the SAS, focused his narrow eyes on all of us with skepticism and disapproval. He finally lasered in on an important expedition member whom he accused of dozing off during the meeting, and whose attitude he had judged lackadaisical. "You've got to tune in mentally right away, now," he said in a grim Scottish brogue. The poor man looked like a deer in the headlights. "Maybe you just think we're talking about our health up here. Maybe you think you already know all about it. And so when you're out there, you're going to get into trouble. And then what? You're going to be hurt or dead. That's what. And who's bloody responsible? We're bloody responsible. So it isn't going to happen on our watch." His squinty gaze swept us all. "Not on our watch." The whole room fell into a heavy silence as we all strived to appear to be paying the utmost attention. After a long, uncomfortable moment, Sully went over the plans for the next day. Two helicopters, the expedition's A-Star and the Honduran military's Bell 412, would fly into the valley to scout out possible landing zones. When landing areas had been chosen, the A-Star chopper would drop Woody, Sully, and Spud in with machetes and chainsaws to clear the LZ. If the brush was thick and high, Sully said, the first few crews in might have to abseil, rappel down, from the hovering chopper. Steve had chosen a group of six people, including me, who would be in the first group to land in the forest, and Sully now had to train us how to do it safely. We followed Sully to the outside patio of the hotel, where he had arranged a duffel bag of gear. He showed us how to put on a climbing harness, how to edge out on the pontoon of a hovering chopper, abseil down a rope using a mechanical slowing device called a descender, unclip, signal, and move away. I had had some experience rappelling down cliffs and frozen waterfalls, but that was always with the security of a vertical face to put my feet on as I descended. Roping down from a hovering chopper in free space seemed less secure, and if you didn't properly release yourself once on the ground, the chopper might take off with you still attached. We each practiced the maneuver multiple times until we had nailed it to Sully's exacting standards. The small A-Star that would go in first could only carry three passengers, or two with gear. The final question was who exactly out of our lucky five would get a coveted spot on the very first flight. Elkins had already adjudicated some angry disputes among members of the team as to who would be included. Chris argued successfully that he had to be on the first flight in because he needed to make sure the LZ was not itself an archaeological site that would be damaged by helicopter landings. Dave Yoder demanded to be on that first flight so that he could capture the moment when Boots first hit the ground. One of his fundamental principles as a photographer was never to shoot a reenactment. Steve assigned the third seat to Lucian Reed, the DP, director of photography, of the film crew, so he could record the moment on film. I would fly in on the second trip with Juan Carlos and a load of essential gear. The five of us and Woody's team would make a primitive camp that night. The rest of the expedition, including Steve, would fly into the valley in the succeeding days. Excited as he was to be fulfilling a lifelong dream, Steve had sacrificed his own early place in the helicopter for us, because he felt it was important to get the filmmakers, the writer, and the scientists into the valley first. He would fly in the following day. The Honduran military, with their larger helicopter, would have to find a landing zone farther downriver. The soldiers would then have to hike up the river to establish a camp behind ours. So for that first day and night, we would be on our own. Chapter 14. Don't Pick the Flowers. On February 16th at dawn, the advance team piled into a van and drove to El Aguacate Airport, a shabby jungle airstrip built by the CIA during the Contra War. It was located near the base of the mountains, about 10 miles east of Catacamas. The two helicopters were waiting. The A-Star, brightly painted in candy apple red and white, which had been flown down from Albuquerque, and a Honduran Bell 412 painted in combat gray. This first flight was to be a visual reconnaissance only, to scout out the two possible landing zones, one below the archaeological site, the other at the junction of the two rivers. There would be no landing in T1 on this aerial mission. I rode in the Honduran chopper with Dave Yoder, while Elkins rode in the A-Star. We took off at 9:45 a.m., heading northeastward under the agreement that the two birds would stay in visual contact with each other at all times. The Honduran helicopter I was in had trouble getting off the ground, and then immediately began flying erratically, with a tilt. As we flew, various red lights and an alarm went off on the console, and then we turned around and headed back to Aguacate, where the helicopter made a crooked, skidding landing. It turned out a computer controller had gone bad. I'd been in sketchy aircraft before, But a helicopter is another level of concern, because if the engine fails, there is no glide. The pilot must try to execute an unpowered descent, which is a euphemism for dropping out of the sky like a stone. Because helicopters are very expensive to fly and require much maintenance, the Honduran military can't afford to give its helicopter pilots the same number of flying hours that, for example, U.S. Air Force pilots have. Even less reassuring was the fact that these helicopters were old and had cycled through the air assets of several foreign countries before being acquired by Honduras. As we waited at the airstrip, the A-Star finally returned. Despite the agreement to stick together, the A-Star had gone ahead anyway. Elkins bounded out. "Bingo," he said, raising his thumb with a grin. "We can land right at the site. But you can't see the ruins at all, it's so thick." The Honduran Air Force brought in a replacement bell, and both choppers made a second reconnaissance later in the day into the valley of T1. This time, the A-Star pilot wanted to hover over the potential landing zone and scout it out more thoroughly. The military chopper, on the other hand, would be examining the bigger landing zone downriver to see if it could accommodate its larger size. As the two LZs were only a few miles apart, the two birds would fly in together and maintain visual contact throughout. Once again, I flew in the military chopper. For half an hour, we were flying over steep terrain, but vast areas of the mountainsides had been cleared, even on slopes of 40 to 50 degrees. This was all new territory to me. In 2012, we had flown in from the northwest. Now, we were flying in from the southwest. I could see that the clearing was not for timbering. It appeared that few, if any, trees had been taken out and were left lying on the ground to dry out and be burned, as evidenced by the plumes of smoke rising everywhere. The ultimate goal, I could see, was to turn the land into grazing for cattle, which dotted even the steepest hillsides. Finally, we left the clear cuts behind and were flying over a virgin carpet of jungle-cloaked peaks. Once again, I had the strong feeling, when flying into the valley, that I was leaving the 21st century entirely. A precipitous ridge loomed ahead, marking the southern boundary of T1. The pilot headed for a V-notch in it. When we cleared the gap, the valley opened up in a rolling landscape of emerald and gold, dappled with the shadows of clouds. The two sinuous rivers ran through it, clear and bright, the sunlight flashing off their riffled waters as the chopper banked. I remembered it from the LIDAR flight 3 years ago, but now it looked even more splendid. Towering rainforest trees, draped in vines and flowers, carpeted the hills, giving way to sunny glades along the riverbanks. Flocks of egrets flew below, white dots drifting against the green, and the treetops thrashed with the movement of unseen monkeys. As had been true in 2012, there was no sign of human life. Not a road, trail, or wisp of smoke. In the larger bell, we followed the winding path of the river. The A-Star was ahead and below us, and as we closed into the upper LZ, the one near the ruins, the A-Star went into a hover over an area along the riverbank covered with thick vegetation. We spent 20 minutes circling this LZ, and then circled the second one downriver, which was larger and more open. With both landing zones now firmly identified, one for the Bell and the other for the A-Star, we headed back to Aguacate. The next morning on February 17th, we arrived back at Aguacate at dawn for our flight into the valley, where we hoped to land and establish base camp. The airstrip terminal, a shabby, one-room concrete building, its ceiling tiles falling down, was now full of gear. Portable generators, stacks of water bottles, toilet paper, plastic bins packed with Mountain House freeze-dried food, tarps, Coleman lanterns, folding tables, tents, chairs, cots, parachute cord, and other necessities. The A-Star took off with Woody, Sully, and Spud, equipped with machetes and a chainsaw to clear the landing zone near the ruins. The chopper returned 2 hours later, having successfully dropped them into an area alongside the stream where there were only a few trees, with a plant cover 6 to 9 feet deep, which could be easily cleared with machetes. Only a few small trees would have to be cut. All was going according to plan. It would probably take them 4 hours to clear it. We would not have to rope down from a hover after all. The chopper would be able to land firmly on the ground. Chris Fisher, Dave Yoder, and Lucian Reed went in the next flight. 2 hours later, the chopper returned and refueled, and then Juan Carlos and I walked out into the hot tarmac to get in. We each had backpacks with all our essential gear, including food and water for 2 days, as the camp would not be fully stocked for at least 48 hours. We would have to be self-sufficient for those first few days. Because the LZ at the site was so small, and the A-Star unable to carry more than a tiny amount of equipment, most of it would be ferried into the valley on the Bell, offloaded at the downstream LZ, and from there, shuttled in by the A-Star in many back-and-forth trips. Juan Carlos and I stowed our two backpacks in a basket attached to the port side of the helicopter, since there wasn't room inside. Steve Elkins brought out his iPhone, and he taped me as I gave a 10-second video farewell to my wife, Christine, since I would be out of contact for the next 9 or 10 days. It was strange to think about what might happen before I was next in touch with her. Steve promised to email the video to her when he got back to Catacamas. Just before we lifted off, I had a chance to chat with our co-pilot, Rolando Zuniga Bode, a lieutenant in the Honduran Air Force. My grandmother used to talk about Ciudad Blanca all the time, he said. She had a lot of stories. What stories? Rolando dismissed them with a wave of his hand. You know, the usual old superstitions. She said the conquistadors found the White City and went in there. But they made a mistake. They picked the flowers, and they all died. He laughed and wagged his finger. Don't pick the flowers! Juan Carlos and I donned our helmets and buckled in. He was excited. When I first saw the images with the buildings, the dimensions of those things, they are big. I had 10,000 questions. Now, we're about to find the answers. After the helicopter took off, we fell silent, taking pictures of the amazingly green and rugged landscape unfurling below. There's Las Cruces, Juan Carlos said. I asked the pilot to take us this way. I looked down at the remote archaeological site, the largest that had ever been found in Mosquitia, before the identification of T1 and T3. In an open, grassy area, I could see a series of sharp mounds, earthworks, and plazas situated on both sides of the Rio Anar. Many had speculated that this was Mord's lost city of the monkey god, but of course now we know Mord had found no such thing and had never even entered this region of Mosquitia. It looks a lot like T1, don't you think? Juan Carlos said. I agreed. From the air, it looked strikingly similar to the LIDAR images. The same bus-like mounds, same plazas, same parallel embankments. Beyond Las Cruces, the Sirius Mountains loomed up, some almost a mile high. As we maneuvered our way through them, the clear cuts gave way to unbroken cover. At one point, with Rolando at the helm, the chopper swerved violently. Sorry, I dodged a vulture, he said. Finally, the telltale notch into T1 loomed up ahead, and in a moment we had cleared it and were inside the valley. Two scarlet macaws glided below us as we followed the line of the river. Pressed to the window, I took pictures with my Nikon. In a few minutes, the landing zone came into view. A green patch littered with cut vegetation. The chopper turned, slowed, and descended. Woody knelt at the edge of the LZ, signaling the pilot as he came down. The trees and bushes around us thrashed with prop wash as we descended. The river surface whipped into a froth of white water. And then, we were on the ground. We'd been ordered to grab our gear and get clear of the LZ as fast as possible, keeping our heads down. We jumped out and seized our stuff, while Woody and Sully ran to the chopper and unloaded gear and supplies from the basket, throwing them into a pile at the edge of the LZ. In 3 minutes, the chopper was back in the air. I watched it rise above the trees, pivot and disappear. Silence descended, soon filled by a strange loud roaring from the forest. It sounded like some giant machine or dynamo had been started and was cranking up to full speed. "Howler monkeys," said Woody. "They begin calling every time the helicopter comes in and out. They seem to respond to the noise." The landing zone had been macheted from a thick stand of lobster claw heliconia plants, also known as false bird of paradise, their fleshy stumps oozing white sap. The red and white flowers and dark green leaves were strewn everywhere, carpeting much of the LZ. We hadn't just picked the flowers, we'd massacred them. A part of me hoped that Rolando hadn't seen this as we landed. Woody turned to us. "Grab your kit, get a machete, pick out a campsite and get yourself fixed up." He nodded toward the impenetrable wall of jungle. A small, dark hole like a cave had been cut into it, offering a path in. I hoisted my pack, Juan Carlos did the same, and I followed him into the green cave. Three logs had been laid across a pool of mud, and beyond that the freshly cut trail went up a 5-foot embankment. We came out in a deep, gloomy forest, with trees rising like giant cathedral columns into the unseen canopy. Their trunks, 10 to 15 feet in diameter, were braced with massive buttresses and knees. Many were wreathed in strangler figs, called matapalos, tree killers. The howler monkeys continued roaring as my eyes adjusted to the dimness. The air carried a thick, heady scent of earth, flowers, spice, and rotten decay. Here among the big trees, the understory was relatively open and the ground was flat. Chris Fisher, the archaeologist, appeared, wearing a white straw cowboy hat that shone like a beacon in the gloom. "Hey, you guys. Welcome." I looked around. "So, what do we do now?" Woody and the other two SAS men were busy arranging supplies. "You need to find a place to string your hammock. Two trees about this far apart. Let me show you." I followed him through the trees to the campsite, where he had a green hammock set up with a rainfly and mosquito netting. He was lashing together a small table from cut pieces of bamboo and had strung up a tarp to sit under it in case it rained. It was a very good camp, efficient and well-organized. I walked 50 yards into the forest, hoping the distance would preserve my privacy after everyone else arrived. In the jungle, 50 yards is a long way. I found a pleasant area with two small trees the right distance apart. Fisher loaned me his machete, helped me cut a small clearing, and showed me how to hang the hammock. As we worked, we heard a commotion in the treetops. A troop of spider monkeys had collected in the branches above, and they were unhappy. They screeched and hooted, coming down lower, hanging by their tails while shaking branches at us in a rage. After a good half hour of protest, they settled down on a limb, chattering and staring down at me, as if I were a freak of nature. An hour later, Woody came by to check out my camp. He found my hammock job wanting and made some adjustments. He paused to watch the monkeys. "This is their tree," he said, sniffing a couple of times. "Smell that? Monkey piss." But it was getting late, and I didn't want to go to the trouble of moving my camp. I was beyond the fringes of the group and concerned that after dark I would need a good trail so as not to lose my way. I walked back to the LZ, clearing a better trail with a machete, losing my way several times, having to backtrack by following the cut plants. I found Juan Carlos in his newly set up camp. Along with Chris, we went down to the bank of the stream and stared across the river at the wall of trees. It mounted up, tier after tier, a barricade of green and brown, dotted with flowers and screeching birds. Beyond that, no more than 200 yards away, began the edge of the lost city, and the possible earthen pyramid we had seen on the LIDAR images. They were cloaked in rainforest, completely invisible. It was about 5 o'clock in the evening. A soft yellow sun spilled into the rainforest, breaking into rays and flecks of gold, scattering coins on the forest floor. A few fluffy clouds drifted past. The stream, about 3 feet deep and 15 feet wide, was crystal clear, the limpid water burbling over a pebbled bed. All around us, the rainforest chattered with the calls of birds, frogs, and other animals, the sounds mingling together into a pleasing susurrus, punctuated by the call and response of two scarlet macaws, one in a nearby tree, the other distant and invisible. The temperature was 70 degrees, the air clear, fresh, and not humid, perfumed with the sweet smell of flowers and greenery. "Have you noticed?" asked Chris, holding up his hands and smiling. "There aren't any insects?" It was true. The fearful clouds of blood-sucking insects we had been warned about were nowhere to be seen. As I looked around, I thought to myself that I had been right and this was not at all the scary place it had been made out to be. It felt instead like Eden. The sense of danger and unease that I had been carrying as an unconscious weight since Woody's lecture subsided. The SAS team had naturally tried to prepare us for the worst, but they had overdone it. As dusk fell, Woody invited us into his little bivouac area, where he had a tiny stove going with a pot of boiling water for tea and for hydrating our evening's freeze-dried dinners. I opened a packet of chicken tetrazzini, poured in boiling water, and then, when it had absorbed the water, spooned it from the bag into my mouth. I washed it down with a cup of tea, and we stood around listening to Woody, Spud, and Sully tell stories of their adventures in the jungle. Within minutes, night dropped like the shutting of a door. Absolute blackness fell upon us. The sounds of the day morphed into something deeper and mysterious, with trills and scratchings and boomings and calls like the cries of the damned. Now the insects began to make their appearance, starting with the mosquitoes. There was no fire. Woody lit a Coleman lantern that forced back the darkness a little, and we huddled in its pool of light in the great forest while large animals tramped, heard but unseen, in the jungle around us. Woody said he had spent a large part of his life in jungles all over the world, from Asia and Africa to South and Central America. He said he had never been in one like this, so apparently untouched. As he was setting up camp before we arrived, a quail came right up to him, pecking in the dirt. And a wild pig also wandered through, unconcerned by the presence of humans. The spider monkeys, he said, were another sign of an uninhabited area, as they normally flee at the first sight of humans, unless they are in a protected zone. He concluded, "I don't think the animals here have ever seen people before." All three of the ex-SAS team were absurdly bundled up against the insects, covered from head to toe with insect-proof clothing, which included a hood and a head net. "Is that really necessary?" I asked. "I've had dengue fever twice," Woody said, and launched into a shockingly graphic description of the disease, which had almost killed him the second time. "It is called breakbone fever," he said, "because it is so painful, you feel like your bones are breaking." After his tale was over, I noticed everyone quietly applying more DEET. I did the same. Then as night deepened, the sandflies came out, in numbers. Much smaller than mosquitoes, they looked like white motes drifting in the light of the lantern, so small that they made no noise, and you normally don't feel them biting, unlike mosquitoes. The more the night deepened, the more sandflies collected around us. Eager to record some of the stories being told, I hurried back to my hammock on the other side of camp to fetch my notebook. My new headlamp was defective, so Juan Carlos loaned me a crank flashlight. I made my way back to my hammock without difficulty, but on my return, everything looked different in the dark. I halted, hemmed in by dense vegetation, realizing I had somehow veered off my rudimentary trail. The nighttime rainforest was black and alive with noise, the air thick and sweet, the leaves like a wall surrounding me. My flashlight's feeble beam was fading. I took a minute to frantically crank it up to a greater brightness, and then I played it carefully over the ground, looking for my tracks in the forest litter, or any sign of the trail I'd hacked with my machete earlier in the day. Thinking I saw tracks, I moved in that direction, walking quickly, pushing aside the undergrowth with a growing sense of relief, only to be blocked by a mammoth tree trunk. I had never seen this tree before. Disoriented, I had stumbled deeper into the jungle. I took a moment to catch my breath and get my heart rate down. I could neither hear my companions nor see the light from where they were gathered. I thought of calling out to them, asking Woody to come get me, but decided not to expose myself as an idiot this early in the expedition. After intently examining the ground and cranking the light up several more times, I finally found my real tracks and retraced them, bent over and peering at the forest floor, each time waiting to advance until I located the next scuff mark or depression. A few minutes later, I spied a freshly cut leaf lying on the ground, its stem oozing milky sap, and then another. I was back on the trail. Following the slashed leaves and vines like breadcrumbs, I retraced the trail to the center of camp, where I gratefully recognized Juan Carlos's hammock. Thrilled to be safely back in camp, I circled the hammock, probing the wall of forest with my light for the path that would take me to where the rest of the group was chatting. That would be easy. I could now hear the murmur of voices and see the light of the Coleman lantern peeking through the vegetation. On my second circle of the hammock, I froze. As my beam passed over, a huge snake. He was coiled up on the ground, just to one side of Juan Carlos's hammock, 3 feet away from where I stood. Impossible to miss, the snake was the opposite of camouflaged. Even in the dim flashlight beam, it looked practically aglow, the patterns on its scaly back brilliantly etched against the gloomy night, its eyes 2 bright points. It was staring at me, in striking position, its head swaying back and forth, its tongue flicking in and out. I had walked right past it, twice. It seemed mesmerized by the flashlight beam, which was already starting to fade. I hastily cranked it back up into brightness. I backed up slowly until I was out of the snake's range, which I figured might be more than 6 feet. Some snakes are able to strike their entire body length. I have had many encounters with venomous snakes. I've been struck at several times and hit once, a rattler that bounced off the toe of my boot. But I had never in my life faced a snake like this. So fully aroused, so keenly focused, so disturbingly intelligent. If he decided to come at me, I'd not be able to escape. "Hey, guys," I called out, trying to keep my voice steady. "There's a giant snake here." Woody responded, "Get back, but keep the light on it." The snake remained motionless, its gleaming eyes fixed on me. The forest had fallen silent. Woody arrived seconds later, with the rest of the group in tow, their headlamp beams swinging wildly through the murk. "Jesus Christ," someone said loudly. Woody said quietly, "Everyone, stay back, but keep your torches on him. It's a fer de lance." He pulled his machete from its scabbard and, with a few strokes, transformed an adjacent sapling into a 7-foot snake stick, a long pole with a narrow forked end. "I'm going to move him." He advanced toward the snake and, in a sudden thrusting motion, pinned its body to the ground with the forked end of the stick. The snake exploded into furious action, uncoiling, twisting, thrashing, and striking in every direction, spraying venom. Now we saw just how large it really was. Woody worked the forked stick up its body to its neck as the snake continued to whip about. Its tail was vibrating furiously, making a low humming sound. Keeping the neck pinned with the stick and his left hand, Woody crouched and seized it behind the head with his right hand. The snake's body, thick as his arm, slammed against his legs, its dazzling snow-white mouth gaping wide, unsheathing 1.25-inch long fangs that pumped out streams of pale yellow liquid. As its head lashed back and forth, straining to sink its fangs into Woody's fist, it expelled poison all over the back of his hand, causing his skin to bubble. Woody wrestled the snake to the ground and pinned its squirming body with his knees. He pulled a knife from his belt, and with his left hand, never releasing the snake with his right, neatly sliced off the head. He then impaled the snake's head firmly to the ground by driving the knife through it, and only then released the snake. The head, along with its 3 inches of remaining neck, wiggled and struggled, while the headless snake also began to crawl off, and Woody had to pull it back into the pool of light to prevent its escape into the brush. Through the whole struggle, he never uttered a word. The rest of us had been stunned into silence as well. He rose, rinsed his hands, and finally spoke. "I'm sorry I wasn't able to move it. I had to wash the venom off right away." Later he said he was a bit concerned when he felt the poison running into a cut on the back of his hand. He held up the headless snake by the tail, blood still dribbling from its neck. Nobody said a word. The snake's muscles were still flexing slowly. Curious to touch it, I reached out and wrapped my hand around it, feeling the rhythmic writhing of muscles under its cool skin, a queer sensation indeed. The snake was about 6 feet long, its back displaying striking diamond patterns in colors of chocolate mahogany and creamed coffee. Everyone stared at it as the sounds of the night returned. "Nothing like this to sort of concentrate your mind, is there?" Woody said. "Female. They get bigger than the males. This is one of the biggest furred lances I've ever seen." He casually slung the body over his arm. "We could eat it. They're quite delicious. But I've another use for it. When the others arrive tomorrow, they'll need to see this. Everyone needs to be fully aware of what they're getting into here." He added quietly, "There's rarely just one." When I retired that night to my hammock, I could not sleep. The jungle, reverberating with sound, was much noisier than in the daytime. Several times I heard large animals moving past me in the darkness, blundering clumsily through undergrowth, cracking twigs. I lay in the dark, listening to the cacophony of life, thinking about the lethal perfection of the snake and its natural dignity, sorry for what we had done, but rattled by the close call. A bite from a snake like that, if you survived at all, would be a life-altering experience. In a strange way, the encounter sharpened the experience of being here. It amazed me that a valley so primeval and unspoiled could still exist in the 21st century. It was truly a lost world, a place that did not want us and where we did not belong. We planned to enter the ruins the following day. What would we find? I couldn't even begin to imagine it. Chapter 15. All this terrain, everything you see here, has been entirely modified by human hands. I lay awake most of the night in my hammock. It was a high-tech contraption, the underside made of thin nylon, with a top of insect netting and a rainfly above. You entered through a zippered seam in the side, but it left me feeling exposed, and it swayed with every movement I made. I had stopped taking my weekly dose of chloroquinone, an anti-malarial drug, in a fruitless attempt to prevent the insomnia it had been causing, a common side effect. I reasoned that there couldn't be any malaria in an uninhabited place like this, cut off from the world. The night clamor of the jungle was so loud I had to wear earplugs. Chris, on the other hand, confessed to me later that he recorded the night jungle on his iPhone and played it to himself back in Colorado to help calm him down when he was stressed or upset. Sometime in the middle of the night, I got up to pee. I unzipped the hammock and peered out, probing the ground all around with my flashlight, looking for snakes. A cold and clammy mist had descended, and the forest was dripping with condensation. There were no snakes, but the entire forest floor was carpeted with glistening cockroaches, thousands of them, rustling in frantic activity, looking like a greasy, jittering flow, along with dozens of motionless black spiders whose multiple eyes gleamed like pinpoints of green. I peed no more than 2 feet from the hammock and hastily climbed back in. But even in that brief moment, it proved impossible to keep the sandflies from pouring into the hammock's interior space. I spent a good 15 minutes lying on my back, shining my light around, squishing sandflies as they drifted about or landed on the mosquito netting above me. After I had to get out and pee a second time, I damned the British habit of drinking tea before bedtime and swore I would not do so again. What little sleep I did get ended for good at around 5 o'clock in the morning, at first light, when I was awoken by a roaring of howler monkeys, which reverberated through the forest like Godzilla on the march. When I emerged from the hammock, the forest was enveloped in fog, the treetops fading into the mist, water dripping everywhere. For a subtropical jungle, it was surprisingly chilly. We ate a breakfast of freeze-dried scrambled eggs and weak tea. Coffee had not arrived yet. Chris, who seemed to be prepared for everything, had brought caffeine pills for just such a contingency and popped a few. I declined his offer to share. The A-Star couldn't fly in until the fog lifted, which it finally did around mid-morning. The first flight brought in Steve Elkins and 2 members of the film crew, Mark Adams and Josh Feaser. I greeted Steve after the chopper took off. He was walking with a hiking pole and limping, due to chronic nerve damage in his foot. "Nice," he said, looking around. "Welcome to the Mosquitia Four Seasons." Alicia Gonzalez, the expedition's anthropologist, arrived in the second flight, along with Anna Cohen, a graduate student in archaeology at the University of Washington, who was Chris Fisher's field associate. I soon became friendly with Alicia, who was an amazing font of knowledge. With a Ph.D. from the University of Texas at Austin, Alicia was a small, friendly, and imperturbable woman of 60, formerly a senior curator in the Smithsonian's Museum of the American Indian. Of Mexican, Jewish, and Native American ancestry, she was an authority on Mesoamerican trade routes and the indigenous people of Honduras. The chopper also brought in Oscar Neal, chief of archaeology for the Instituto Hondureño de Antropología y Historia, IHAH. Neal was an authority on the ancient cultures of Mosquitia. We unloaded the chopper with the usual haste, throwing everything into a heap to be sorted and carried into camp later. The morning was spent moving supplies and equipment and organizing our campsites. I grabbed a tent and set it up next to my hammock, grateful to be on solid ground. The tent's sewn-in waterproof ground cover would keep out the snakes, spiders, and cockroaches. I enlarged my campsite area with a machete, strung a clothesline, and claimed a folding chair from one of the loads, which I set up under my hammock. There, protected under the rainfly of the hammock, I could sit and write in my notebook, and I could store my clothes, books, camera, and journals in the hammock itself, which made a handy waterproof storage compartment. As the day wore on, Chris Fisher became increasingly impatient, eager to begin our extraordinary task of entering the lost city. I found him down on the riverbank, in his straw cowboy hat, pacing back and forth with a Trimble GPS in his hand. Woody had forbidden anyone to leave camp without an escort due to the danger of snakes and getting lost. "This is ridiculous," Fisher said. "The site is just right there, 200 yards away." He showed me the LED screen on the Trimble, which displayed the LIDAR map and our position on it. I could see that the city was, indeed, right on the other side of the river, completely hidden in the screen of trees. "If Woody doesn't free up someone to take us over there, I'm going by myself. Screw the snakes." Juan Carlos joined us at the steam bank, hands on his hips, staring at the wall of trees on the far side. He, too, was eager to venture into the ruins. "We don't have a lot of time," he said. It was true. We had only 10 potential days to explore the valley, our time being strictly limited by the rental period of the A-Star helicopter from Corporate Helicopters in San Diego. Its pilot, Miles Elsing, had to fly it back to the States, a 4-day journey, for another assignment. "Someone's got to talk to Woody," said Fisher. "This is why we're here." He gestured across the river at the hidden city. "Not boiling water for friggin' tea." Finally, about 3:30 in the afternoon, Woody agreed to lead a reconnaissance into the ancient city. He told us to be at the LZ in a half hour, with our packs fully loaded with the emergency overnight kit. We would have 1 hour in the ruins, no more. At the appointed time, we gathered at the stream, stinking of DEET. There were 8 of us in the group. Myself, Woody, Chris Fisher with a machete in one hand and GPS in the other, Oscar Neal, Juan Carlos, also carrying a fearsome machete, Lucian Reed with a video camera, and Mark Adams with a 40-pound field audio kit consisting of a wireless audio mic system, portable audio mixer recorder, and a 6-foot boom mic with windshield. I couldn't believe Mark was going to hump all that through the jungle. Dave Yoder, burdened with heavy camera equipment, followed in watchful silence, ceaselessly shooting. Steve Elkins could not come. The nerve damage caused by a deteriorating disc in his spine gave him a condition known as drop foot, in which he was unable to control the position of his foot while walking. He felt the jungle was too thick and the hills too steep to take the risk of injury so early in the expedition. He did not want to be laid up or, worse, have to be evacuated. It was a bitter pill to swallow. "If you guys find anything," he said, waving a 2-way radio, "call me." Woody checked our packs to make sure we had all our emergency supplies, and we set off, wading across the stream. On the far side, we encountered a thicket of heliconia that formed a virtually solid wall, but the fleshy stems were easily felled with the swipe of a machete. Woody carved and slashed his way through, one step at a time, the leaves and flowers showering down left and right. The cut vegetation lay so thickly on the ground that there was no possibility of seeing where we were putting our feet. Still shaken by my encounter with the Fur de Lance, I couldn't help but think of all the snakes that must be hiding in that undergrowth. We crossed 2 muddy channels, sinking up to our thighs, struggling through the morass with sucking sounds. The embankment beyond the floodplain was precipitous, close to 40 degrees. We climbed hand and foot, grasping roots and vines and branches, pulling ourselves up, expecting at any moment to come face to face with a Fur de Lance. We could see little beyond a dozen feet in any direction. The embankment abruptly flattened out, and we arrived at a long ditch and mound that Chris and Oscar examined and felt were man-made. They appeared to mark the edge of the city. And then we came to the base of the presumed earthen pyramid. The only indication that this was artificial was that the ground rose sharply in an unnatural change of slope. Until Chris and Oscar pointed it out to me, however, I would never have recognized it. We could see nothing but leaves. Here we were, at the edge of a lost city, and we had no sense of the layout or distribution of the mounds and plazas so crisply visible on the LIDAR maps. The jungle cloaked all. We labored up the side of the suspected pyramid and reached the top. There in front of us were some odd depressions and linear features that Chris believed might be the remains of a structure, perhaps a small temple. Oscar knelt and with a hand tool dug a sondaje, or test pit, into the soil. He said he saw evidence of deliberate construction. I peered at the layers of earth he had exposed just below the surface, but my untrained eye could make out nothing. Even at the top of the pyramid, the highest point of the lost city, we were immersed in a disorder of leaves, vines, flowers, and tree trunks. Chris held his GPS over his head, but he had trouble locating satellites because of the trees. I took many pictures with my Nikon, but they all ended up showing the same thing. Leaves, leaves, and more leaves. Even Dave struggled to get photographs of something other than an endless green ocean of vegetation. We descended the side of the pyramid into the first plaza of the city. The LiDAR images indicated that the plaza was surrounded on three sides by geometric mounds and terraces. As Fisher tried once again to get a GPS reading with his Trimble in order to start ground mapping, Oscar gave a shout. He knelt, brushing dirt and vines off the corner of a large stone, almost completely invisible in the riot of plants. The stone had a shaped surface. After pulling back and cutting away some of the vegetation, we began to uncover more such stones, a long row of them, all flat, resting on tripods of round, white quartz boulders. They looked like altars. "We have to clean these stones," Chris said, "to see if any have carvings, and we need to locate them on the GPS." He pulled out his walkie-talkie and called Elkins back in camp to report the news. They had an excited conversation that we all could hear through the walkie-talkie speaker. Elkins was ecstatic. "This proves," he told Chris, "that they did use cut stone for building. It means this was an important site." The GPS finally located enough satellites for Fisher to begin establishing waypoints and mapping the city. He charged through the jungle, slashing his way, marking waypoints, keen and impatient to make the most of our limited time before we had to return to camp. We could hardly keep up. Beyond the altar stones, we reached the central plaza of the city, which had clearly been at one time a large public space. It was as flat as a soccer pitch and more open than elsewhere. "These were probably once public buildings," said Fisher, indicating the long mounds surrounding the plaza. "Perhaps reserved for an elite class or royalty. All this would have been open and very impressive. I imagine this area was where major ceremonies took place." Standing in the plaza, I finally began to have a sense of the size and scale of the city, if only barely. Chris cut his way across it, saying that there were three more plazas and a possible ball court farther on, along with a peculiar mound we had called the bus because it looked like one in the LiDAR image. These bus-shaped mounds were prominent in both T1 and T3, well-defined, each 100 feet long, 30 feet wide, and 15 feet tall. I had seen several at the site of Las Crucitas. They were a characteristic structure unique to this culture. While the rest of the team stayed behind, clearing the vegetation from the stones, Woody and I followed Fisher northward, trying to keep him in sight. We came to more mounds and a steep ravine cutting through them. Glancing into the cut, I could see where the erosion had exposed what looked like stone paving forming an ancient surface. Fisher hurried on past the ravine, where the jungle became incredibly dense. I did not want to follow him into that frightful tangle, and neither did Woody. He called to Chris not to go any farther, that it was time to go back, but he didn't seem to hear us. Moments later, we saw his white cowboy hat vanish into the forest. The rhythmic swiping of his machete died away into silence. "Bloody hell," Woody muttered, and again called for him to come back. Silence. He called again. Minutes passed. While Woody was not one to express emotion, I could see a look of irritation and concern gathering on his face. Just when we were thinking Chris was gone, we heard his faint voice drifting through the trees, and he emerged back out of the hole he'd cut in the vegetation. "We were concerned you were lost," said Woody, in a clipped voice. "Not with this," he said, waving his GPS. Woody called for a return. While we had been waiting for Chris, the others had come up to the ravine. Using his own GPS, Woody identified a more direct route back to camp, hiking down the ravine to the floodplain where we encountered another barrier of heliconia, which Woody worked his way through, expertly wielding his machete, scattering flowers left and right. We had to cross three parallel channels of sucking mud, once again sinking to our thighs. When we reached the stream, coated with mud, We waded in, rinsing the mud off. While the others went back to camp, I wrung out my clothes and piled them on the pebble beach, and then I lay back in the cool water and floated on my back, letting the river carry me a ways downstream, watching the treetops lazily move past. Back in camp, I found Steve on a cot outside his tent, which he had set up next to my camp on the other side of the spider monkey tree. He was lying on his back eating peanuts and gazing straight up with binoculars at the troop of spider monkeys. They, in turn, were lined up on a limb 50 feet above, staring down at him and eating leaves. It was a funny sight, two curious primate species observing each other with fascination. Steve was absolutely beaming over the discovery of the altar stones and full of self-reproach for not having gone with us. He asked questions about how tough the hike was, and I assured him that, although it was steep and slippery, and the mud holes were appalling, it was only a few hundred yards, and I was pretty sure he could do it if he took it slow. "Screw the leg," he said. "I'm going up there tomorrow, one way or another." That night we sat around eating freeze-dried beans and rice to the light of a Coleman lantern. I avoided tea, although I did accept a tot of whiskey from Woody, rationed out in a bottle cap. Chris was elated. "It's just as I thought," he said. "All this terrain, everything you see here, has been entirely modified by human hands." In one short reconnaissance, he had confirmed the accuracy of the LIDAR survey, verifying on the ground every feature seen in the images, along with a great deal more. The ground truthing had begun. A rising wind breathed through the treetops. "That means rain," said Woody. "In 10 minutes." Right on schedule, the downpour thundered into the treetops. It took a good 2 or 3 minutes for the water to work its way down through the canopy and reach us on the ground, and then streams of water came cascading everywhere. Chapter 16. I can't move my legs at all. I'm going down. After night fell, I crawled in my tent, glad to be on solid ground and out of the dreaded hammock. I read my Dover edition of John Lloyd Stevens by flashlight as the rain drummed down. Despite the rain, snakes, mud, and insects, I felt exhilarated, not just by the lost city, but by the feral perfection of the valley. I had been in many wilderness areas, but never in a place as purely untrammeled as this. The hostility of the environment only added to the feeling of being the first to explore and discover an unknown place. I awoke at 5 to the roar of howler monkeys rising above the pounding of rain. It was a morning so dark it didn't seem as if daytime had arrived at all. The forest was wrapped in a twilight gloom, cloaked in mist. Chris was up and, as usual, impatient to the point of zeal to continue his work. The camp kitchen and gathering area had now been partly erected. We assembled under blue tarps strung up over several plastic folding tables. One camp stove was boiling water, and the other heating a pot of coffee, now that the supply of coffee had finally arrived. Outside, the rain was turning the jungle floor into greasy mud that seemed to deepen with every passing hour. The water collected in the hollows of the tarp, which periodically had to be pushed up with poles to dump the puddles of water off the edges. At breakfast, several people reported having heard a jaguar prowling about the edges of the camp in the dead of night, making a rumbling, purring noise. Woody assured us that jaguars almost never attack humans, although I wondered about that, given Bruce Heineke's story. Others were concerned that the large animals heard stumbling about might blunder into a tent, but Woody dismissed that as unlikely, explaining that the animals that came out at night could see quite well in the dark. "There are 4 more plazas I want to look at," Chris said, gulping his coffee. "Upriver is a weird L-shaped mound. I want to see that. And about a kilometer downriver is another set of plazas I want to see. There's a lot to do. Let's get going." I had donned my raincoat, but the rain was so heavy that water began to trickle in anyway, and wearing it made me sticky and hot. I noticed none of Woody's team were wearing rain gear. They were going about their business completely and cheerfully soaked. "Take it off," Woody said to me. "Best to get it over with all at once. Trust me,